My name is Chester Higgins. I'm a photographer in New York. I went to a school called Tuskegee in Alabama, where I met the photographer P.H. Polk, who was a student of one of the staff photographers of Booker T. Washington. And I have been very interested in the telling the story, the positive story, the full story of people of color who have been marginalized in the white mind and the white press. And because I don't think it's white people's responsibility to correct our story, it's our responsibility. I've taken it upon myself to spend the last, since 67 when I picked up the camera, to spend that time trying to capture the most positive way the images of people of color. Because what's lacking in the media are three significant things when you see people of color. And that's the issues of decency, dignity, and virtuous character. And that's what I have tried to make sure that in all of my photographs, that those bases are touched, that I have the subject matter, I have my own artistic imprint, but I'm looking also to check off those boxes of decency, dignity, and virtuous character.
No, I find that to be such a core element, even for myself, because I think when you live in the West, you eventually start realizing there is that disconnect, and that disconnection is the visual representation. And if you look at how people of color are represented globally, there is that thread that binds us. And this is where I completely agree with you. It's, we have to find these solutions ourselves. And I mean, for me, I have to say the story is that when, I remember when I came across your book, and I've said this in other interviews, but when I came across your book In the Spirit, I mean, it was really, it was an opportunity for me to realize, wow, like, I don't need to veer into any other things, that it is okay for me to focus on the subjects that interest me, which is my own people. And then to see a black and white book on top of that, I was like, wow, like, it is okay to shoot black and white. Because if you remember before, you know, there's always this thing, especially during analog time, that you have to shoot in color. And for the life of me, I could not shoot color at all. So when I came, imagine I was at Howard, when I came across your book, I was like, wow, okay, if he's able to do it, then I can do it. And this is why I think we don't know who we impact at the end of the day. And this is why it's so relevant to create work. But within that, just speaking about your earlier work that you've done, I mean, you've captured moments in history in the African-American community. You know, you have really been diligent of your approach. But if you can speak about your experience of working in print media and also working on your personal projects, how did you balance these two things?
Well, I worked for the New York Times for 49, was it? Almost 40 years. But I tell people that I'm a photographer not because I want to be at the New York Times, but the New York Times is very important because I wanted, if I truly believed in what I'm doing, then what that feeling, that vision needs to be on the national stage. And what made the New York Times important to my work is that it is the paper of decision makers in this country. So all of these, I can't compete with the Birth of the Nation in one way, but I can do it in another way. And all those people who went to white elite schools and they were shown that film, Birth of a Nation, as an informational thing, that's the only idea they had about black people. Now they were being confronted in their New York Times with other images that were positive about black people. So I wanted to spread, develop some space in people's heads for an alternative view. And coming with the authorization of New York Times, then a view, an informational view of fact. So my way of working has always been the same. The thing is to try to find avenues to get the work out, avenues that will resonate, that will expand, and that will get people's attention and make them think again. Because when you bring new stuff to people, there's always the feeling of pushback. Oh, wait, what is this about? And before there's a feeling of acceptance. So I just had to keep plugging and plugging and plugging. And now in a few months, I'm getting from the New York City media editors, all of them white, an organization called Celeriums. And they're now giving me their Lifetime Achievement Award saying that I have taught them more about Black culture single-handedly than anybody else that they just didn't know about. These are people who, you know, I've had to work with, and people who were in the early days, editors who looked at my, I will come back with a job, and they look at my contact sheet, and they would find it hard to find a picture because it didn't fit the cliches. And they had to keep working. But I never gave them the opportunity to find another different kind of picture. Because I had a talk with Gordon Parks in 71. And Gordon, you know, and Gordon and I were both on the same boat as we want to change the image of our people. So Gordon says, look, Chester, if that's how you really feel, a roll of film has 36 frames on it. If you shoot the 35 the way you feel, that's fine. But if you slip and shoot the 36 in the cliche form, that's the one they're going to use. So don't give them a choice. So I said, okay, I'm not going to shoot that 36. I'm not going to slip up and shoot the 36 anyway in a cliche, but okay. That was like, you know, saying, okay, this is a rule. Stick by it. Don't play muckety muck with this, you know. Do what you're going to do, because how else can you educate people unless you bring them new material, unless you force them?
Yeah, but I mean, the question that I have for you then is that, I mean, I know from being in the States, it's very difficult to enter these, you know, different media outlets. I mean, entering the New York Times, I'm curious to know, like, how did you get into the New York Times? Because I know that must not have been an easy journey, just as Gordon Parks had a journey also to get to where he you know, ended up. And but how did you manage to be in the New York Times?
Well, you know, having faith that a no is not acceptable, and finding a way to competitively get their attention. So that means in the old days, first getting an appointment, second making a portfolio that was compelling. And then I have to also say that allies help. White allies, I first came and I worked with Look magazine, and the Look magazine went out of business after I did my first story. I had a 5-page spread. Arthur Rothstein was a mentor to me. I found out in the Depression days, he had visited Tuskegee, and he was really captured by my energy. And when the magazine went out of business, he made a lot of phone calls for me. See this guy, take a look at what he's got. You make a decision, but take a look at him. So, you know, all of it worked, and showing up on time, and being business, taking care of business. Because see, the thing with editors is that their job is on the line too. They don't want their editor to come back to you and say, what is this junk? You know, how did you do this? So you have to help them look good. And as long as they feel that you are going to produce the job and you're gonna produce the kind of quality on time that they're looking for, they can then and take a chance. And that chance is, you only want one chance. And that chance, you know, speaking of chances, I went to Time Magazine because here I am, you know, I'm new to the city. I got two kids, a young family. The kids, you know, you can't, and a freelance a salary is up and down, you know, but a kid's stomach and hunger remains the same. So you gotta hustle. So I went to Time Magazine, and this woman gave me an assignment. I think she really didn't like me, but she was gonna, this was her way of sort of telling everybody that we shouldn't use him. And they sent me to photograph this guy, Rabbi Kahane, who is a rabid racist against Arabs. He started a thing called Jewish Defense League. Well, I didn't know anything about it. You know, so he gave me an address. I show up at this address. It looks like an almost abandoned building on 42nd Street and 10th Avenue. I knock on the door, and this guy who's thuggish comes to the door with his beret on. Who are you? I said, well, I'm with Time Magazine. I'm here to photograph Rabbi Kahane. So he slams the door back in my face. And then he comes back down and he says, okay, come in. And then they march me down a corridor. And these guys, these thugs on either side are like this, you know, on the corridor. And I'm looking at this. And I said, fuck this. You know, I mean, I come from Alabama. I come from a place where, you know, you have guns. Because you know that the white guy has guns, he wanna shoot you. And the only reason he won't shoot you is he's afraid you will shoot back. So, you know, and I've been through the civil rights period, so thugs don't bother me. You know, my position is that if we have to go down, I'm not the only one going down. So I don't have a fear, I'm going through it. So I go up to the back of the building, walk up to the second floor, and I walk into this room, and this slight Jewish guy, back is to me. And he turns around and he looks at me up and down and very dismissively and says, oh, they sent you. I said, well, yes. And I got right to work. I said, okay, now I need you to stand here. I need you to look this way, blah, blah, blah. I got my pictures and left. Back down to the corridor and got, you know, but, you know, I think in retrospect that had they sent a New Yorker black person to do that job, that person not only would have been intimidated, but they would not have produced the work. Because the intimidation really is about, you know, okay, people can have their whatever attitude they want, but, you know, unless they want to go down, why is that a problem? So that was my thing. And I, and so Time Magazine ran the picture. So I didn't have any more problems.
But for me, it's also, I mean, I'm pretty sure when you were, you know, working as a staff, I'm pretty sure there wasn't a lot of people of color. I mean, especially for photographers. I mean, this is even a current issue in itself.
Absolutely.
But how did you deal with, because the one thing that I know is that there's heavy competition. There's always, you know, who's doing what and so forth. I mean, there's a whole other internal ecosystem as it relates to the photo section of any newspaper, but how did you manage through all of that and to still stay on top and to still stay true to what you wanted to represent?
Well, are you asking me how did I survive the back knifing of my white photographer colleagues who were always up front and talking to their editors who knew what the assignments were and tried to grab off the first assignments, the best assignments before I could hear about it? Yeah, well, I let them do that. I refused to get into that game. But what I did is I used my time bringing in images of black folks that they would not have been looking at. Making sure that, hey, I was there to take care. My responsibility being here black is to take care of my people. If they think that that's what is gonna help them, let them run with that. But gradually over time, I could compete for those other things as well. You know, of course, you don't win every time. You lose more than you win. But because I had my own mission and my own work outside of the paper, it maintained my sanity. So, now, with this new award I'm getting, some of those very people who were always sabotaging me now have come to see that they should praise me, because they did not realize that I had a vision and I was a long-term game, and it was and had outdistanced them in every way.
No, I mean, and I always find that interesting when the tables turn. I mean, that's the unfortunate part of the industry within it, but. And also, I mean, looking at your work, and this is one thing that I would like you to share, is that every frame that you have, there's a level of intimacy. I mean, there's obviously poetry within it, and there's a closeness to your subject. And I assume, regardless of what assignment that you received, I assume you must have a set of goals that you always focused on. But how did you build that trust? I'm sure this didn't happen overnight. I mean, it took time to build into that. And I think this is maybe what working at the New York Times, it gave you that opportunity to sort of grow in strength and, you know, be more precise. But I'm curious to know, how do you build that to get it right?
To build that bridge of humanity. I told this one photographer who was a star photographer at the paper, who, you know, white photographers are great with process. He asked me one day, he says, you know, well, how do you do your portraits? And I say, I talk to people. He was dumbfounded. He didn't know what that meant, because that's not what he does. So when I go and do a portrait, I have been taught that you try, if you know, from Look Magazine days, I was taught that if you're going to do a portrait of somebody, if they're an artist especially, or if they've written something, try to read what they've done, listen to what they produce, find out as much as you can about them so that you at least have some understanding of the person. And then when you are finally with the person, to me, it's very important to have a conversation, to build a bridge, to find out where is it that we can understand each other as human beings. So, you know, as in the African tradition, how's the family? How many children you have? You know, stuff that has absolutely nothing to do about their position, but has to do with their humanity. And based upon, and then I know, because I've studied the person, I know these other things I can bring out as the conversation goes on if I need to spice it up with any of that stuff. But the important thing is that Bill is to find common humanity, to find a common bridge. And then on that bridge, everything else opens up. Because that finding that common humanity allows you in essentially to emotionally hug, develop a situation where you and the subject hug each other. Because the bottom line is that you will always get better pictures from people who feel that you are not there to judge them, that you accept them as who they are. And that's what I try to do with everybody. I'm not here to judge you. You've got to live your own life. You're living your own life. And let's just, you know, I'm a passing thing. I'm just passing by. Once I had to photograph this judge, and I asked the judge at the end of doing the session, I said, well, are you fair? Thought it was a good, nice question. And the guy said, whatever he said, I forget. But then the guy died the next day. So that picture became a front page picture. I don't know if that was something triggering that, but you know, it's always good to, I believe sometimes it's good, especially if you get a recalcitrant subject. I believe in using a 2x4 and knocking them in the forehead. Because, you know, that's the only way you want to, I had to do that once I had to photograph this law firm, big law firm. And then the managing partner of the law firm, I'm trying to arrange the people for the picture, and he's trying to arrange the people. And I had to say, hey, excuse me, in front of everybody. Excuse me, I'm the photographer. And he said, oh. And everybody else went like, oh. Let me get my picture and get the hell out of here. You're wasting my time. I know how to make this picture work.
No, but I think we've all encountered that in one form or another. So, I mean, the other thing also that something I've never asked you, and I mean, I've read bits and pieces of it, but when you decided, okay, I'm going to go to Africa, the first time that you decided to come to Africa, I mean, I don't need to say this to you. I know that a lot of the times within the African-American community, there's always this misconception that, you know, folks have as it relates to what Africa is. And you decided to come to Africa when it wasn't popular, when it wasn't the whole... sort of exploration into the continent hasn't really happened. I mean, right now, you know, you look at contemporary art, you look at music videos, all of that. Now we see all of a sudden the incorporations of African realities within these things. But what made you, I mean, you come from Alabama, you came to New York, which was already a step in itself. And then you decided, okay, I need to go to Africa. I mean, what triggered that you said, okay, I have to be over there?
Well, two things. I've learned from being in the South and the corruption of the media about my people that I have no faith in what white people say about us. I even remember talking in New York to when I was trying to research going to Africa and in 69 and having listening to the gall of some white people tell me in nice society dinners that, you know, well, African people don't really have anything in common with you people, and that, you know, you're not gonna find anybody, you know, who can relate to you. These are white people, missionary kind of people, telling me that my people don't have anything in common with me. But, you know, I listen, but, you know, I don't get my information from them. When the spirit speaks to me and it says, hey, you know, I know this other blood looks like me. We can talk. We don't need you to talk. And you had never really been instrumental or helpful in my development or the development of my people. So why should I put stock in what you say to me or any of your people say to me? You've corrupted everything there is about us. So what legitimacy do you have to talk to me about this? This is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm going to do. I don't know what the results is going to be, but I know I won't find out unless I go. My mother even said to me, well, son, that's a long way. But, you know, each year I kept coming back and she got okay. She was okay with it. And I was sharing pictures with her and stuff. So, you know, it's, I always tell people that I had to go to Africa because one, America reject all people of color. Number two, that has to be my future. And they're all cousins. We've always, this our whole family has been separated, been splintered, but we're all cousins. And I have cousins here, so I can go find my cousins there. You are not a cousin. you have your best friend sometimes with cousins. So I treated myself. I wanted to find and make connections to the other half of myself that had been separated. I want to find and make connection with my future. And Africa is the future.
Because, you know, when I look at the work that you have produced, especially relating to, the Horn of Africa, and now looking at your new book, before we get into that, I think a lot of photographers, especially those in the continent, and I mean, obviously in other regions as well, that there's never a consideration of why publishing is such an important component. I think out of all the photographers that I know, I mean, the ones that have mentored me, I think you were probably one of the few that had many books published. Why is making a book such an important component to the career of a photographer? And how has that played a role for you as well? Because you could have just stayed in your newspaper gig, you know, getting your month-to-month assignments or, you know, or what have you. But why was it important that you make a book and continue to make books?
Well, for me, books are codifying some of the things that I say and I hold dear about people who look like me. Newspapers are great. You know, that's one kind of legitimization. But I really want to reach to my people about issues that require time and that you can just treat in a very liberal way. I mean, liberal with a lot. I mean, you take a book, a normal book may have 100, 150 pictures. Now my books have more than that. But I think it's been important to find a way to say to everybody who agree with me that, look, here is a group of, a book of visual evidence that says who I am, that says who we are. And it then becomes a collective exercise of enjoyment, a collective exercise of interrogation. And it is all about, I think, all my work is about reaffirming our agency to do what we do in our own, as we observe the humanity and express the humanity in ourselves. And that's what it's always been about. Now, over time, as before there was not really a market for art photography like I do, but all the photographers, early photographers, have done books, and those books have now become catalogs for people who are doing collection. But for me, I think the books have always been about how do I codify a statement that means a lot to me, and that I think and I hope would mean a lot to enough people to buy it. You never know. You know, you as an artist, you're always working in a vacuum. You don't know how people are going to respond to it. I've always had, every year I've traveled to Africa and I've invested money and I've got my equipment, I got my film, I got my ticket. And I always have that night of crisis and faith before I take off. And that crisis and faith comes down to what if they don't accept me? What if I can't work? What if, you know, if it's, you know, bureaucratic or emotional or what have you? All of this money I've invested is like go in time, it goes up in a puff. But there again, every year, in the end, I step out on faith. The faith in myself, the faith in the project, the faith in the people. And that's what has brought me to be able to maintain, to have a great time, maintain a lot of friendship, relationships and friendships, and produce work and bring it back to the Americas to show my fellow cousins here that people like us live like us, and that we should also be proud, we should be attractive. I've always wanted to use my work to create an emotional attachment between Africans, continental Africans, and African Americans. Yes, I grew up in an environment where so many African Americans have been, because we look at the white media, we look at Birth of a Nation, and we are ashamed of ourselves. We internalize the shame that whites who hate us have made us feel. Malcolm X was right. Who made you hate yourself? It was not you. It was the whites who made you hate yourself. So don't carry that water for them. Find another way to create the water, your own water, that you can see that by loving yourself, there's nothing to be ashamed about that. And not only just loving yourself, let's not just, you know, have stars in our eyes, but let's see how many different kinds of experiences we share. The experiences of intimacy, of friendship, working together, trying to make things happen, problem solving, all of that, to reinforce the linkages of our humanity, to say, hey, because, you know, in the end, politically, what I would love to see, African-Americans galvanize politically so that we force our country to look out and support Africa the way Jews in this country force this country to support Israel. It's a possibility, but only if we are connected. What makes the Jewish example work is because you have this strong emotional tie. If we can only have that strong emotional tie, I mean, we had it during the war in 1936, when African Americans wanted to go to Ethiopia and fight against the fascists. What happened? The American government stopped them. They said, no, you can't do that. You can go to Spain and fight, you know, against the fascists there. That's why, Dunbar wrote, maybe Langston Hughes wrote the poem that says, well, this is not Ethiopia, but this is a do. Because this is where the black people who wanted to go fight in Ethiopia were diverted to. Not to mention, you know, I mean, there was all of this. There have been pockets from Marcus Garvey. There have been pockets. It's there. It's a latent thing that people have to get over. Of course you got, but there are people who swallowed this whole thing. I remember I went to talk to Ralph Ellison to photograph him. And Ralph Ellison and I had a bridge. We both went to Tuskegee. But I had just come from one of my yearly trips to Africa, and Ralph was asking me what I was doing. I said, well, I did this and this, and I was over in Africa, and blah, 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 blah. So Ralph says to me, you went to Africa? I said, yeah. He said, we ain't lost nothing in Africa. I said, well, maybe you haven't lost anything in Africa, but I have a great time when I go to Africa. And he was like astounded, because he was coming from the perspective that we have invested so much blood and sweat in being Americans. But see, what Ralph misunderstands, and what a lot of people misunderstand, is that to be an African-American is a very unique and flawed position. Because the reality is, we are Africans without memory, and we are Americans without full rights. And somehow we like to think that poof, that we have no history and we just like fell out of the sky. So this is this is what the propaganda has caused in the minds of our people over time. So my thing is, how can I help our people move from that propaganda jailhouse and free themselves and seeing themselves in a larger perspective, seeing themselves larger than their neighborhood, larger than their street corner, larger than their city or state? How can I get them to see that there's a world out there that looks like them? So my first three books were all on African-American, Black Woman, Drums of Life on Black Men, Some Time Ago, The History of Blacks in America from 1850 to 1950, and then I jump off to Africa with Feeling the Spirit. But one thing I did in the first time I did the book on Africa, Feeling the Spirit, is that I made sure that the first chapter was not about slavery. See, people forget, slavery is not our history. Slavery is an interruption of our history. But if we look at the propaganda, everybody's talking, well, you know, do you want to be a kid in a classroom and some white teacher tells you your history began in slavery? How does that encourage you to be anything? So since nobody else did the primary research, I had to be a cultural anthropologist and go so that book, the first chapter starts off what I call most ancient place, Ethiopia, Egypt, East Africa. Then the migration across the continent to West Africa, then the interruption of slavery and water, and then the humanity of all the people, regardless of what condition they're in. Because, you know, since the Europeans conquered Africa, we don't all like to admit it because it's normalized, but we all people of color are living in not only an apartheid South Africa, we're living in an apartheid world. It's just been normalized and we don't see it, but that's what the situation, that's what the issue is.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that even when I remember feeling the spirits, you had like a section of South America as well. I think you had like things in Brazil and I think you were connecting.
Suriname?
Yeah, I think you were, what I understood from the book was that you were connecting what binds us as opposed to the ugliness of what has divided us, you know?
Right.
And in those things, I always find the Sacred Nile, I think, you know, it's a very well done book. And I know that for you, you spent a lot of time in that region. And it seems that, you know, you always come back. And I wanted to know, like, every time that you come back, do you see new things or are you finding new things within that? And also, why has this region become so important to you? Because as you stated, you've initially landed in Senegal and you went to Ghana. And historically, you know, there's a lot of things to discuss in those regions as well. But what brought you to continuously keep coming back? Because as far as I've known you, like, you've been coming to East Africa for a long time. So, I mean, we'll take you, we'll claim you. We have no problems with that. But I just wanted to elaborate a little bit about it. Don't tell the West Africans, but, you know, I'm
just kidding. I love us all. We're all a big family. I love it. I love it. You know, 1973, there was this man who was the secretary for Malcolm X when he broke away from the Nation of Islam. And after Malcolm was assassinated, he became a editor, cultural editor at Ebony Magazine. His name is Peter Bailey. I think he's in his 90s now. Peter had an opportunity to go to Egypt. And Peter, bless his heart, he says, Chester, you need to come with me on this trip. I said, oh yeah, I'm ready. A week in Egypt, I'm ready. And he said, well, okay. It was a press junket. He said, I'm going to tell them that they, you know, you do photography and you can help do a brochure. I said, great. We get to Egypt. My God. The first morning there, Cairo is noisy, noisy. I'm in this hotel about on the 25th floor and I walk out to look at the noise on the balcony and my eyes are stuck. 5 miles away, this huge pointed mountain, the pyramids. I've never seen this before. It's not part of our culture of architecture. We are used to straight up and down. We're not used to slants. And it's not used to our sense of the functional resonance of architecture that the pyramid does. So for a week, I'm like going through these temples and tombs and I'm just like in complete awe. And I'm looking at these pictures and these are Black folks. I didn't hear of these Black folks. And what I've heard of them, they were totally discredited because the book of Exodus tell you how bad they were. But wait a minute, here are these people who are doing religious stuff. How could all of that mix? There's something missing here. And there I go, kick in again, not to trust white scholarship. I gotta make my own, I gotta start from zero. Black scholarship, I get the work. And as the spirit would have it, that week or 10-day trip to Egypt extended itself to 6 weeks. Why? Because I went there in August. September, Egypt declared war on Israel and attacked them. All the airports shut down. Nowhere to get out the country. So finally, 6 weeks later, because we're on this press tour, we have to take a bus. We go across the desert to Benghazi, Libya, catch a plane to Rome and get back. I had more time. The spirit had locked me in, locked me down. I had more time now to go to the museums, to look at stuff and just question and being dissatisfied with answers it set me on a road of knowing that when I got back home, I need to start reading books on Egypt. So I start reading over years. I started becoming essentially an Egyptologist, just, you know, self-researcher, which I have no problems with. I love research. And that's what every year when I go back to Ethiopia, you ask me if there's something different. Yes, because every year I spend 11 months researching for the place I'm going to go to, because I'm looking for evidence of our continuity, evidence of our unification? And where is that evidence of our history? And when I discover those things, that's how I come up with my itinerary, my wish list. So every time I come back, I have discovered something else that leads me to something else that I didn't see. Let's say Ethiopia. You know, in your country, as I'm studying religion, of African religions in the West Coast, I discovered something very early that in African, had I not gone to Ethiopia, to Egypt first, I would have been a real messed up. In West Africa, the religions of African faith seem like they have nothing in connection to each other. Part of it has to do with the language. All the deities have different kinds of names, and some of it has to do with the practice, and all of it has to do with the Christian stop sign, don't pay attention to this. But I discovered by reading and studying Egyptian faith first, I was able to recognize the symbolisms that were in Egypt, that were taken away by people who were non-literate, but they took away pieces of the symbolisms and they reestablished those in African societies. So I'm learning all around Africa where the indigenous religion is, except Ethiopia, because you know, Ethiopia gave up its indigenous religion. Queen of Sheba gave up the indigenous religion for a foreign religion. She decided that Ethiopia, through her son, would become Jewish. So essentially, the Jewish faith took over the state. That's the reality. Now, it took me, I've been traveling to Ethiopia. I got there in 73, 74, 75. I stayed away doing the Derg. I went back after the Derg was over. And then I'm trying to look, you know, and I'm looking for the Christian. Obviously, the Christian is the first thing you run into. You can't get away from it. I had to dig to find the Islam. And then by chance one night, I'm at a New Year's Eve party in New York, Brooklyn, New York, with Jessica Harris, culinary cultural anthropologist. And what's the Ethiopian chef? Marcus Samuelson comes to visit her. And Marcus has a photographer with him. And this photographer is showing this spread they did in some fashion magazine on foods from Mikado. But he had a picture of these three women who were kneeling by the water. And I knew that was not Christian. I said, what is this? And the photographer, Gideon Kifle, said, well, I don't really know what it is, but this woman took me there. She's doing her paper. And I said, well, put me in touch with this woman. So Meskerem Asagu was doing this paper because she grew up as a child and her grandmother lived in Beshoftu, or Debrezeit. And she remembers that her grandmother would do these rituals. And now, even though her family had ran away from the country because of political turmoil, lived in Washington, she wanted to go back and research this. And it was her research and her paper that opened up this whole thing that's been undercover about Ethiopia, this world of the Oromos and the Oromo religion of Wakafana. And then I went back 3 or 4 years with her, following her research. She would lead me into communities she'd been working with, photograph those. Then I kept reading and I found other things to find. So that it was just, the answer to the question is that life is pretty much like an onion. You know, you can see it all, but you don't see anything. You have to peel back each layer. It is a discovery. And you cry because of, the things, as you try to reconcile some things, you cry because of things you lost. Every time I go to Egypt these days, and I just came back from a month, you know, I cry. My heart cried a lot this time because all of this no longer existed. I mean, when I first went to Egypt and I saw this, you know, I cried because, my God, I wish I was here at this particular time. But this obviously is here, left behind, which tell me the party happened long ago. There's no way for me to get to that party. So, you know, it happens. So you have to keep working. You have to keep working your projects. You have to keep digging. You know, it's like a mine digger. The deeper you dig, the more that comes up. And at some point, you'll know when you've hit pay dirt.